Gavin Ortland, it is a pleasure to be with you today. I am grateful for your friendship, and I have been amazed by how your YouTube ministry has grown, the impact you've had on countless lives. And I'm so excited that our listeners today are going to be able to hear some of the highs and the lows, the good, the bad, the ugly, that you've experienced along this journey as a YouTube influencer. So let's just start from the top. Pick it up wherever you'd like.
Yeah, I started a YouTube channel in 2020, August of 2020, a couple months into the pandemic. And it began to grow. And over the years, to my astonishment, I began to feel just this deep sense of feeling called to that form of ministry. And it's a big, long story, but the heart of it is just needing to, loving everything I'm doing, but just needing to focus a bit more on where I'm seeing the most fruit and where I feel most drawn. And we've talked just a moment ago before we started about our desire for revival, our heart for young people. And that's just so deep in my heart. That's what I'm trying to give my life to.
I think in this digital age, and when we know that so many of the young people are on social media, I mean, it makes perfect sense. At what point did you, I mean, I'm sure it was gradual, but at what point did you realize, in maybe talking with your wife, like, yeah, we're just going to have to pray about what this may look like to shift, to have more of the focus be on this new, this online presence, this ministry?
I can't remember an exact day or time, but I can think back on just some of the thoughts that were coming in. One of them is I was struggling a little bit with burnout. Not deep into it, but realizing I was kind of bumping into that space and just trying to think, how do I pull back? The other thing I remember is just the notes I would be getting. And I've always felt like in my ministry, I see some fruit. I see God at work. But the things I was hearing from people were the kind of things you hear where you say, okay, this is working. I need to do this. I need to push into this. And some of those notes just meant so much to me. You get emails or you get a Facebook message and somebody's saying, hey, here's how the Lord used this video. And those began to stack up to the point where I felt like, okay, I need to start thinking about this. And yeah, it was a huge mindset shift. I never would have thought like that. I mean, no one talks about the dangers of social media more than I do. And so it's kind of, I say to my own astonishment, because I genuinely know there are temptations in that calling, but I also think God can use it for good.
Oh, absolutely. So let's talk about the whole, because it seems like a lot of the traction. I mean, I think it initially, I don't think you set out to say, yeah, I want to debate a lot of the Catholic apologists in that. You were more or less just providing a lot of sound doctrine and church history and just equipping, you know, other Protestants. At what point did this kind of shift to where it's like all of a sudden you're making videos, you know, about purgatory and the Assumption of Mary? And so I want to know about that. And then when did you get that first, you know, invitation or rebuttal video?
Oh, yeah. I don't remember the first rebuttal video. I'd have to go back and do a search. I'm sure we could probably find out.
All right.
I remember the first debate I did. And this shift you're talking about is definitely true. I mean, when I began, I had just published a book on the existence of God. And so the basic reason I started a YouTube channel is I was thinking, lots of people will never read this book, but they are interested in these ideas.
Right.
And YouTube is, for better or for worse, it's where people go to debate things and so forth. So my initial thinking was this will be apologetics, it'll be theology. Historically, I haven't really been someone who's been in kind of Protestant versus Eastern Orthodox and Roman Catholic type conversations. I'm interested in that, but it's not really been my focus. And then I think what just drew me into it was just the need.
Yeah.
I really think it was just that simple. There's all these people giving arguments against Protestantism, and I was just amazed at how little there was on the other side defending historic Protestant views. Part of my journey has been to try to find this balance of speaking the truth, but doing it in love and without any lack of personal respect, trying to maintain positive relationships. I have friends in these traditions. I think there are Christians in these traditions. So we can learn from them, and the issues are not simple. So in light of that, one of the things I always try to do, and I'm very imperfect in this. I mean, believe me, I look back on things and I can see how I've maybe gone in different directions at different times, trying to tweak things. But I try to just never even go to thinking about motive, even in my own heart and mind. I just always assume the best motive and say, I'm going to be I'm going to err on the side of naivety rather than cynicism, just because that helps me. Yeah. Somebody else might approach that differently. I'm not saying that's a law for everybody, but I do think it's good to be careful about that. So I don't even think about the motive. I'm honored that there's engagement because it means they think it's worth engaging.
Yeah.
Some of them are pretty nasty. I mean, there's harassment. I mean, I've had to contact a lawyer to protect my family from some people. Those people are not representative of any major Christian tradition.
Okay.
They're just troubled people. But that's a dynamic, and that's part of the price you pay. But for most of them, I feel honored that they engage, and then I just try to navigate it. And the big question is, you know, I really want to give my life for Christ.
Yeah.
So the big question is, how do I steward this?
Yeah.
Because even just apart from the topics we're addressing, like if it's about purgatory or something like that, that matters. But even apart from that, there's this broader question of how are people watching Christians disagree? And that's one of my deep convictions these days, is part of apologetics is without compromise to be irenic, to be gracious, to be truly loving, to truly wish well upon the soul of that other person, to pray for them.
Yeah.
That is not just a talking point that we move on from. That's part of our message. That's part of how we commend Christ. And so very imperfectly, I'm seeking to do that and learning as I go. I don't want to just do Protestantism. I'm happy to do that.
Sure.
And I'll still do that.
Sure.
I have a few videos already planned out in that territory. But I also just have such a burden for people who are deconstructing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people who are leaving their faith right
now. Oh, absolutely.
I want to speak into those conversations.
Yeah.
I am grieved at people. I think sometimes people, they leave the faith without really looking down the road.
Right.
And really thinking through how dark the implications are from an atheistic perspective.
No.
There's not a lot of hope there.
I'm just grateful for everything that you're doing and just to find someone like-minded that's so burdened by this. I mean, I lose sleep sometimes. I mean, I just pray constantly for revival and for people to just take the scripture seriously.
Me too. I pray every day for revival.
Yeah.
I think, as we've talked about, you know, Gen Z and the younger folks, a lot of these people are very open. They're very spiritually open.
Yes.
They don't even necessarily have baggage in some cases at all. They're just open because they don't have any background to it sometimes. Sometimes it's very new to people. So, I do pray for that. I hope for that. And it's a thrilling thought that the gospel is really true. I mean, I come back to this in my own work in apologetics.
Right.
When I study the resurrection of Christ, I can't tell you how happy that makes me.
Yeah.
And I come back to it and I'm like, oh, this is really true. And we really have good reasons to believe that it's true.
Right.
I've never been an advocate that historical arguments can get you to this kind of mathematical certainty. The approach I take is more of a kind of an abductive approach of saying, what's the best way to make sense of the world?
Yeah.
But with the resurrection of Christ, it's kind of amazing how strong of a case can be made.
Absolutely.
I was blown away.
Right.
I looked into it and I thought, oh, surely this happened 2,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Surely you can't make that good of a case. I was kind of astonished at just how difficult the alternative explanations for the launch of the Christian church and the basic facts that we encounter is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I come back to that, I say, this is true. And then you just say, think how thrilling that is.
Yeah.
That there actually is a transcendent hope. Think how wonderful it is that life doesn't end at the grave.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Tim Keller. He's got a great quote about the resurrection and just how it's different from other views of the afterlife and how it's the happiest possible view
Absolutely.
Of the afterlife, because it means the suffering of this world will be turned to glory for those who have trusted in Christ.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing that could be even possibly happier than that I can think of.
Yeah.
That not only will suffering end, it'll actually be turned to good. If people really allow that to land upon their heart, I think it's hard not to be moved by that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and I think in having the courage to, engage with friends who don't know the Lord, and some that may proclaim, you know, have a different religious affiliation, you know, denominationally or whatever, but to let this be at the center of our conversations, to pray for opportunities to truly, you know, to talk about the Lord, to talk about the gospel, the truth, you know, and to do, even to have debates. I mean, I think it's such a healthy thing. I find so much hope in the fact that I'll go to some of these parochial schools, these Christian schools, these secondary schools, these high schools, and to know they have a debate team or club, and they'll actually, I mean, in some of these non-covenantal Christian schools where you don't have to be a Christian to go there. And I was a part of one where you had kind of the leading atheists of the school that was always, you know, keeping people on their toes or in check, and, you know, sometimes annoying. But yet then you had the Christian who was just Jesus everything and sometimes annoying. But you had to have them reverse roles. And so this, you know, professing atheist kid had to read, you know, some of the great works of the fathers and scripture and make the case for theism, for Christianity. Mm-hmm. And you had to have this, you know, this apologist, this Christian kid try to argue for atheism. Mm-hmm. But when they did it, and when we had this really just candid dialogue, and I said, well, what did you learn? Tell me what you learned the most. And they said, well, we realized that we just had these so many preconceived notions and assumptions that were just wrong, or that we just heard about the other, you know, side or whatever. And we also realized how little we knew about our own beliefs that we had been, you know, espousing for so long. And so I'm so much more sympathetic or empathetic now for those that don't see things eye to eye, but just the process of having an opportunity to have genuine dialogue and debate in a healthy way, what it's done just for my own soul. Yeah. And I think that's so important. And I know you're really getting at that with Truth Unites and all. And if you, for those listening or watching this, if you're not familiar with Truth Unites on YouTube, you need to subscribe and start listening to Kevin Ortlund, because he's providing that space for so many people. And I know, you know, many friends I've had that, you know, they're not getting this type of in-depth analysis or, you know, conversation. And so thank you for continuing to do what you're doing. And I mean, what a blessing. Yeah. And I look forward to the books that are coming out as well. Let's talk a little bit about, because I've had a few people say, you know, I watch Gavin religiously, but I don't know anything about him, you know, other than, you know, he's got a wonderful wife and five children, and they now live in Franklin, Tennessee. But let's talk. I'd be really curious to know a little bit about, if you don't mind sharing, just what the average day looks like in terms of just your spiritual journey with the disciplines. Or, you know, how do you start the day? Are you a morning person? Do you find yourself reading or studying or thinking or praying more at night? Or is it throughout the day? And what does that look like?
Yeah, I'm not a morning person.
Yeah, nor am I.
So when you have young kids, you kind of learn to adjust, all of that. I mean, everything is flexible, including the daily schedule. I'm a big believer in doing quiet times, but keeping them non-laborious and simple. So my practice is very simple. I'll find a book of the Bible, I'll have a sheet of paper in there, and I'll just read until something prompts me to pray.
Okay.
And then I'll write out a short prayer, and then I close the Bible and come at it the next day. I like writing them out because then you can see them, you can look back on them. Sometimes it takes me 2 minutes, sometimes it's 10, you know. And then I'll do other times of prayer that are longer, but they're more sporadic, and a lot of times I like to go on a walk. Or just be outside.
Okay.
So I loved hiking in California. There's not as much hiking here as there was in Ojai. Was perfect for that. So you could just walk right up to the trails from our house. But just anything I can do to be outside. And then when I swim, also, I swim and bike almost every day.
All right.
And that's usually in the mid-afternoon. So I'm usually up early, lots of coffee, working hard, both with helping in the morning with the kids, and then studying, working on things. And then I exercise in the middle of the afternoon so that I'm not trying to work the full. I start to crash, you know, at a certain point, and that kind of, then I can get a few hours of fresh work in after that. And then the evenings, it's all about the kids. Okay. 5 to 8 p.m. is the most energetic part of the day.
Sure.
Everything you can imagine, wrestling, playing soccer. Soccer's been the thing lately in the backyard, play soccer with the kids. But yeah, in terms of spiritual disciplines, a lot of times, so when I'm swimming or biking, that's where I was going with that.
Yeah, yeah.
I've found that it helps to just practice gratitude. My life is too busy to try to be super intentional about things, but if I can just have the discipline of when I'm in the water or when I'm riding a bike, I can't be distracted by my phone, and so my mind is free, and I'll just try to identify things I'm grateful for. Mm-hmm. And just simple prayer, Lord, thank you for this.
Yeah.
Thank you for this.
Absolutely.
And that practice has absolutely changed my life. I it's been way more powerful than I thought. I expected it would make a little bit of a difference.
Yeah.
I would say on any given day, it changes my emotional status by about 30-35%.
I agree. No, I do too. Even when you're upset or angry at someone, or if you've been, in your case, just, you know, criticized to no end, I think just to still be grateful and to even pray, you know, the whole praying for enemies, you know, I think it's, and Anselm, you're an Anselm scholar, right? he has a quote, and it's something along the lines of, it's like, you know, pray not for their demise, but for their salvation, but yet also realizing that at the end, he's not far from any one of them in terms of that don't know Christ yet.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. Even in times where I've been depressed or I've been suffering. And the criticism doesn't affect me too much. There's been a couple times where weirdly, it doesn't hurt my feelings,
right.
But I get down simply by the darkness of it sometimes.
Yeah.
That's happened two or three times where this inundation comes and you just feel, it's like I don't think it's affecting me,
right.
But then I realize I'm down and I'm sad. And I think it's just the sheer darkness of it. For the most part, the criticism doesn't hurt me too much. But there's times where I've been suffering in some way. And gratitude is possible even when we're suffering.
Yeah.
You can just thank the Lord for the air you're breathing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's amazing if you draw your mind to the blessings in your life, how many things you can think of.
Yeah.
And I found that as a way to sustain yourself through those times.
I know there are a lot of those in vocational ministry that listen to you quite a bit. And you alluded to the fact of maybe on the brink of burnout, and that was part of what God used to know that you needed to make some adjustments. But it was all healthy in a good way. But just for those that might be listening that might not be aware of the fact that they need to step back, or what could you suggest? I just think it's all too common that once people realize they're burned out, it's, I'm not gonna say it's too late, but there should have been some boundaries or parameters or things in place that are safety guards or whatever, just to help them know that, you know, maybe I need to step out and let someone preach for me this next Sunday, or maybe I need to get away. I mean, from your own experience, or maybe not personally, but through family and this lineage of preachers and that, what advice might you give?
Yeah, I've thought about this so much in my own life.
Yeah.
With my phone, I've gotten very disciplined. There's certain rooms of the house I never bring my phone into.
Okay, good.
There's certain times of the week I just totally unplug. And I have to revisit those boundaries every 3 months or so and see how am I doing with this, because that's a big cause for me of times where if my brain is just going too quickly,
right.
I get this unpleasant clutter in my mind that is, it's not healthy. So that's one part of it. But when I give counsel to pastors about this, one of the things I talk about is friendship.
Yeah.
I think a lot of pastors are lonely, and it's just it's an easy vocation in which to not make real friends.
Oh yeah, totally.
Because you're giving yourself to people, but you're doing so in this unique role. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes they don't see you as an equal as much, and there's always that dynamic of you being the pastor.
Yep.
So just being able to allow yourself to invest in, and then you move a lot sometimes as a pastor too.
Right.
But friendships are a huge part of life.
Yeah,
I mean, one of the things that makes life happy is when you have good friends.
Yeah.
And so that's one thing I love to encourage people to think about, because sometimes we overlook that. And
yeah.
We just forget that this is a big factor in things like burnout. Another thing would be hobbies.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's really healthy for pastors to have something that they enjoy.
Yeah, absolutely.
That isn't in their ministry.
Yeah.
And it's whether it's a sport you get into.
You mentioned biking and swimming. And
Yeah, that kind of stuff. I started playing soccer with some folks in Ojai, and I loved being out there on the soccer field.
Yeah.
And nobody knows that I'm a pastor. Now, eventually they found out.
Right.
but I wasn't relating in that mode. It was just guys playing soccer.
Yeah, yeah.
And we weren't even talking that much. You're just playing. But something about that was really rejuvenating for me.
Yeah.
So I think just finding healthy hobbies like that and outlets. And then the other thing I just would say is don't feel guilty about really asking for a sabbatical when you need one.
Yeah,
or other kinds of rest. Because I've had pastors who say, I thought I needed to leave the ministry. Then I went on a sabbatical and I realized I just needed a break.
Yeah.
And 6 months later, or even 1 month into it, you might feel differently. And so just not feeling guilty.
Yeah.
For those of us who don't like to ask for a lot, it can be a lot to feel like we're asking our elders for, or whoever we're asking. But just recognizing this is a good thing. And it goes back to Genesis 1 and the principle there with the Sabbath rest. So it's not wrong to just completely unplug and take time to restore your soul.
No, I agree. I could not agree more. You know, and I'll shift just a little bit, but you know, when the Wesleys, the brothers, you know, the Holy Club, the pejorative nickname that they were given, you know, they would have these groups, but there was a lot of accountability with the small groups. And I don't know if you've heard this, but there was one question that they would ask of one another every time they met was, how have you sinned today? How have you sinned today? And I thought, wow, okay, that would definitely take some close friends to ask me that, or that I would want to be transparent with. But to your point, I think we've got to have that. You know, we've got to have time for rest, but I think also accountability. And I'm curious with, I mean, you've got your brothers, you've got others that, you know, have walked the journey with you for many, many years. But with this, I'm not going to call it newfound fame, but like this, I mean, you're growing in popularity in that. Do you find yourself out just in public, maybe not in Franklin, but maybe in Ohio, you know, where you were in California, that are people recognizing you? I mean, is it like, oh, that's Gavin Ortlund, or I know he's familiar. What's that like?
That is a weird dynamic of being on YouTube where people see your face so much. It has happened a couple times, and it happens increasingly a little bit. So it's weird. I don't know what to think about that, except just to be grateful.
Yeah.
Because usually people are saying something kind.
Yeah.
So you're just grateful for that. And then, you know, with all that, you just have to, I have to come back to this prayer. Lord, if there's any favor I have, if there's any influence I have, make me willing, make me hold it open-handedly and try to steward it for the kingdom. And make me willing on a dime to just give it all up.
Yeah. Hold on to it very loosely.
If you call me to do that.
Yeah.
And the simple prayer and reminder that just helps me is realizing how fast life goes and how soon we will be standing before Christ.
Yeah.
Because I turned 40 last summer.
Okay.
And each year just feels like it's flying by.
It does, somehow.
And I'm aware of that everything of this world is so fleeting.
It really is.
And it just helps me to remember that.
No, I agree. My grandmother had a little plaque that we would see before we would leave her house, and it said, just one life. It'll soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ will last. And so we all have a eulogy. It's being written. One day we'll be gone and someone will write up, and rightly so, all these nice things that we were allowed to do or accomplish, you know, and never the negative. And that's fine, you know, and that's good. And I get it. But being able to reflect and look back, I'd like to, you know, ask the question in terms of adversity, you know, and what you learned from it. Like, is there a thing or two that maybe happened along the way that really drew you closest to God?
Yes.
That you care to share.
Yeah. There's been a couple things that my wife and I have been through together. I think I could probably share, two things that come to mind. One would be ministry suffering. Mm-hmm. We've not suffered in grandiose ways as many people do. But we've suffered in ministry, and in one particular episode, not at our church in Ojai. Ojai was a wonderful, we have nothing but love and gratitude for that church. Mm-hmm. Previous to that, we had an experience where we were mistreated at a church.
Okay.
I have instant compassion for pastors who are mistreated. I understand. It's a unique kind of pain.
Right.
When there's betrayal, when your reputation is damaged, when things are said about you that aren't true, that really hurts.
Yeah.
And because being a pastor is such a joy, and you give your heart to people, when there is a backlash or when there's mistreatment, it's a particular kind of pain, just because of that love you have for people. So that is something God has taught me a lot through. I think the main thing is to have understanding and empathy for those who are suffering.
Yeah.
That's one thing I can thank God for. I'm able to sit down with someone and really feel this instinct. It's funny when someone starts sharing if they're depressed or if they're really struggling with something and they're really scraping by.
Yeah,
I just find in my heart this longing to just draw near to them.
Yeah, you've been there. Yeah,
because I know what that feels like, and I know how bad somebody needs a friend, and they don't need you to say much.
Right.
You don't need to have answers.
Mm-hmm.
They don't need your brilliant interpretations, but just love and presence and just a friend. And just to be there, you know, so that's something I aspire to be like.
Yeah.
The other thing I was going to mention is just going through times of kind of angst in my faith.
Mm.
And there's been two episodes like that.
Okay.
Nothing grandiose, nothing like, oh, some big fireworks, you know, just the age old question of what if I'm wrong?
Mm-hmm.
Or what if I'm missing something here? And just simple question of just working through things. How do I know that, you know? And in both of those times, God has used both of those. It's like the Puritans use this metaphor of when a storm comes through,
mm-hmm.
and it loosens the soil. And you think the tree is going to fall over,
right?
Because it's being beaten so much.
Yeah.
But because the soil is loosened, the roots go down all the deeper. Mm-hmm. Both of those seasons of my life have given me this deeper sense of stability and confidence in my Christian faith.
I love that.
In my love for Jesus, my confidence in the truth of the gospel.
Yeah.
But with that too, there's an empathy of I want to help people who are struggling with doubt. That's not easy, and it's a very common experience.
Right.
So I want to be a friend to those who are going through that.
Yeah, no, thanks for sharing that. I really appreciate that. I think it was Lewis that said you can't wholeheartedly embrace something as truth unless you first doubted it. So to convey to people that doubt is normal, it's in fact, I think it's necessary, and it's okay to work through it, and it's okay to say, I don't know, you know? And I think, and especially on YouTube, right, when you're in the middle of something and you're like, I'm not sure, but I'll get back with you. And I appreciate you, you know, being willing to offer that to say, well, I'll find that quote or I'll post it, remind me in the comments or whatever to do that, because it shows your listeners or your viewers that, you know, you're on a journey and you're basically, it's almost like the pastor that, you know, you don't have, I don't know who said this, probably multiple people, but you shouldn't really be in the pulpit preaching a sermon that hasn't first impacted you, right? And I think what I can tell from what you're doing on YouTube with Truth Unites is that you're truly being impacted by your research and what you're discovering. Yes. And then you're sharing that with, you know. Oh, yeah.
The gospel's enchanting and these topics I'm addressing, I hope people feel that. I hope, because I feel that as I'm studying these things.
Yeah.
This is thrilling. I mean, this is the great question.
Yeah.
You know, the God question.
Right.
That is everything.
Yeah.
It affects everything else, and you see everything else in its light. So, and the truth of the gospel couldn't be more wonderful. It should fill our hearts with happiness. So I hope that comes across to people. And just as you said about saying, I don't know, that's the kind of apologist. I don't even know how I feel about the word apologist or apologetics.
Right.
Sometimes it can connote things that are not things I aspire to, but there's good things about it too.
Sure.
But the kind of apologist I aspire to be is one who's always willing to say, I don't know.
Yeah.
If I truly don't know, because if I'm not doing that, then I'm actually not a trustworthy person to people.
I agree. And I think at the end of, you know, the whole be prepared in season, out of season, you know, but I think the end of that with do this with gentleness and respect, I think that's where it comes in, right? That you're gentle knowing that, hey, I'm confident in this, but I'm also willing to sincerely listen to your, you know, your argument or your side. And when they know you're sincere about that, I think it's disarming. As opposed to just thinking, you know, I'm right, you're wrong, I'm going to be dogmatic, and I'm going to prove to you that you're wrong. And I think for too many apologists, that they may not mean to come across that way, but that's the tone. And it's just really off-putting. You know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, we were talking about this earlier, about the worst thing would be is if, you know, you approach a topic, not that you're scared of any of them, but that it would be so offensive, or you would come across in a way that would be such a punch in the mouth from the get-go that you couldn't even have the dialogue.
Totally.
Yeah.
That's the, in the book, How to Disagree Without Being a Jerk, the first chapter is on kindness.
Yeah.
And it's all about it, the way kindness opens up doors.
Yeah.
It's not just a virtue that is good.
Right.
It's also just helpful.
Yeah.
In dialogue. It just, you know, it creates space for listening and understanding. And I talk about the character Alyosha in the novel The Brothers Karamazov.
Yeah, yeah.
And his simple, sincere kindness and lack of contempt, lack of looking down on others, lack of exasperation with others, you know, even in their wretchedness. He's patient. He's kind. And that's what sort of redeems everything in the end. And I really believe that.
You know? I do too. Yeah.
People sometimes even make fun of me for trying so hard to be kind.
Yeah.
And I know we can do it imperfectly.
Yeah.
But I will always believe in the power of kindness. And
absolutely.
It's not easy to do.
Yeah.
Truly to wish well upon people in your heart, it's not easy. It takes a strength and a resolve and a commitment to do that. But I just believe that's how we will be effective.
Right.
Just as you're saying from 1 Peter 3:15, that's how we'll be effective in promoting Christ.
Oh, absolutely. No, I agree 100%. And again, these, and especially the younger people, they see through a lot of the facade, the mask, the BS, whatever you want to call it. And they know when you care and you sincerely are just meeting them where they're at. And you're listening. Oh, the ministry of listening, right? It's so powerful and yet often neglected, because as leaders or preachers or whatever, we feel like we have to always be talking. And it's like, no, just be quiet. I'll never forget. It was Dan Rather, CBS or whatever it was. But anyway, 60 Minutes. I don't know. But Dan Rather was sitting down with Mother Teresa. And he said, you know, gosh, you're just this, you know, this saint, and you're so revered, and you help the poor just with most of your time. And if you're not with the poor, you're praying for and with them. And so just to talk about prayer for a minute, you know, when you talk to God, what does he say? Or he said, what do you say to God? And she said, well, you know, I just listen. And she says, well, what does God say to you? And she says, he listens. I don't know if you've heard that before.
I hadn't heard that.
But I think the ministry of listening and the power of that. From your own experience, has there been any particular writings that really prompted you to want to pray in a different way?
Yes. The Practice of the Presence of God by Brother Lawrence.
Yes.
Is in the top three books probably for me that's impacted me. And it's a simple appeal in some ways that he's making, but just this idea that we can be mindful of God at all times. Mm-hmm. He talks about doing the dishes can be done as an act of worshiping God, being mindful of him while you're doing the dishes. Mm-hmm. Simple idea, but just that idea of being of mindfulness to the presence of God, and then in all things, opening up your heart to God. You know, whatever you're doing, having an open heart to the Lord and communing with God in all things, in his creation, in a personal conversation with someone else like this. We're open, heart is open to the Lord. It's so, so beautiful. It's such a powerful, when you realize that, it's like, how can I not have joy in my life?
But when it's all said and done and someone's going to write that eulogy about you, what do you want people to say and remember about you when it's all said and done?
Yeah. It's a wonderful, thrilling thought to not need it to be about me, but because if I want to be seen in some way or something like that, ultimately that's kind of suffocating and kind of a dead end, and it doesn't lead to the kind of expansive joy that Christ puts in our hearts. But if I want people to see something of Jesus through my life, then there's joy. And that's what I want. I want people to see something of Christ in my life. I would love, as we've said, you know, I pray every day for revival. I pray that there's so much pain in the world. There's so much confusion right now. The church is struggling in so many ways. I would love, if I could give my life to anything, I would love to be someone who in some way contributes to the end of people coming to Christ.
Yeah.
And a new wave of people experiencing the gospel. I would love to see revival and renewal. I would love to see people who are confused and in the dark step into the light and understand how much Jesus loves them.
Right.
And so that's what I want my life to be about. That's sort of what I want to be known for.